Now, way back in 1936, this jar was discovered in Iraq. And shortly after its discovery, someone posited that it might have been an early battery, a form of galvanic cell. It does have a copper tube that surrounds an iron bar, and there was some residue inside that was acidic, maybe wine or vinegar. Now, this has caused all manner of hoopla and debate, very polarizing. If you're into ancient high tech, this is proof that the ancients harnessed and used electricity. If you're skeptical of those kinds of claims, well, you don't see any wiring in the record, you don't see any light bulbs, there's no ancient computers, no electroplated statues, no robots, so what were they using it for? Why did they need electricity if we don't have any evidence of them using it? And now, I've taken the skeptics' arguments, because let's be honest, healthy skepticism is important, but I've also taken the way that a galvanic cell works. And looking into this, I believe that I've found the answer. And I don't usually say that very often, but I'm pretty certain in this case that there's evidence for what I'm going to tell you, and that this is the most simple, elegant, and it explains what we see in the record. And anyway, if you got a few minutes, sit down and let me tell you the real use of the Baghdad Battery. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. In order to understand my hypothesis, you will need to understand how a galvanic cell works. And I know that I said I was going to make one of these in the past. And look, you could ask any of my exes. I am really, really good at making promises that I just don't follow through on. Usually in those cases, I can just hand them a couple of AA batteries and walk away. But the problem here is I don't have a battery, right? But, you know, at any rate, I'm going to try to actually edumacate you here as well as crack a few stupid jokes and entertain you. But it is important that you understand how a galvanic cell works. So strap yourself in so I can explain it. A galvanic cell is a form of battery. And batteries, by definition, make electric energy from chemical energy. A galvanic cell uses the process of oxidation and the related process of reduction to generate a flow of electrons. Two metals will be used, in our case, iron and copper. And one metal will be designated the anode, which will be the negative pole of the cell, and the other the cathode, which will be the positive. It is important that these metals have a difference in potential. Both metals are submerged in electrolytic solution. Now, in our case, the solution is mixed, but in an optimized galvanic cell, like a Daniell cell, for example, they use a different solution for the anode and the cathode for better results. At any rate, the point on the cathode where it meets a solution will cause the free electrons in the solution to be drawn to the cathode in a process called reduction. And this causes the cathode to slowly get plated in any metals that are in the solution. In turn, the anode reacts by shedding some of its electrons in a process called oxidation. So in a nutshell, the cathode accumulates electrons, and this causes the anode to shed electrons. And this flow of free electrons through the solution is literally what electricity is. And so you have the definition of a battery, a chemical reaction that's creating electricity. Now, the electricity produced is minuscule, and due to the lack of refinement, the batteries wouldn't have worked for very long either. You old people like me can think Sega Game Gear levels of battery life. So we can assume that they weren't using like motors or LEDs or really much of anything that calls for very much electricity at all. And as many have pointed out, we don't have any wiring in the record.
There is no evidence of any wires in the first place.
Do you see this house? That was wired in like the 60s, but it was stripped of every scrap of copper back in 2023. Are we to assume there was never any electricity in this house due to the fact that there's no copper wire in there now? Now, I know it's crazy, but maybe there was wiring around way back then and somebody took it, sold the wires, brought the money to their plug, and then, or maybe they had better use for it, and it's like the iron that was stolen out of the Colosseum. They looted it to make weapons with, right? And, you know, this is really a low bar to debunk these kinds of things with, but the fact of the matter is we do have no shortage of skeptics that a lot of these arguments are just crap. Now, some of them are good. Some of them are just crap. And this is something I'm going to talk about a little bit on my other channel. Link down below. I'm going to be premiering that video shortly after this one's done, so you can walk right from one to the other. Now, there's a book excerpt that gets into the arguments against this jar being a battery. And in addition to what I've mentioned already, they point out that there's other jars with iron and copper inside found very near the site of Kujut Rabu, which is where the original Baghdad battery was said to be discovered. And some of these pots had scrolls inside of them made of parchment. And as a result, the paper's authors have argued that these were all made to hold scrolls and that the iron and copper was a symbolic or a ritualistic thing. Also, one of the arguments brought against is there's no way to access the copper anode, or excuse me, cathode. In a lot of these situations, you can't reach both posts of the battery, so how could you get the electricity out? And another argument is that there's no buildup of metal on the anode, or excuse me, again, the cathode. There should be some buildup on the copper, and at least something on the side of the pot, something. There is metal that gets floated around in there, so where is it going? Why is there no residue? And that's a good point, but it actually brings me to what I think these things were used for. I don't think that they use these for electricity. I think these were used the same way a gold miner would use a gold pan. It's to get metal that was too small to access with the hand. Now, if the solution used is completely devoid of metal, hydrogen will be really the only substance to go through reduction, and as such, bubbles will be the only accumulation seen at the cathode. However, if the solution has metal dissolved in it, then that metal may accumulate on the cathode. Now, it may not, depending on how active the metal is. Now, the less reactive metals, also called noble metals, are less likely to be affected by chemistry or rust or other things like that. The more reactive metals, well, they're more likely to be affected by things like chemicals and rust. The more reactive metals are things like iron and nickel and magnesium. And those ones all fall to the bottom of the little battery there as slime, as sludge. But you know what collects on the cathode? Gold, silver, copper, mercury, but mercury can be melted off. Copper can be melted off, and you end up with gold and silver together. And if only one of the two was present in the solution, you end up with nearly pure silver or gold. Now, copper is easily separated from gold and silver with smelting, and mercury was used by the Romans to extract silver and gold through ore from a process called amalgamation. And after they combined the mercury with one of those other elements, they would heat the alloy up and the mercury would just go away as vapor. Puff, puff, give, buddy. But where would they find a solution so loaded with those precious metals? That's actually easy, man. It would be the runoff from a mine, right? That's already really acidic. It's going to have those precious metals in it. And the only noble metals that you're going to find in most ancient mines were gold, silver, mercury, and copper. And as we've already covered, it's easy to separate the precious metals out of that. So they could scrape the accumulation off of the copper cathode and anything on the inside of the jar because it would be very valuable to them. This explains why we don't see residue on the cathode. It was harvested. And this is why some don't have contact points to the electrodes. The electricity wasn't even the desired result. They may not have even known these things could generate power, but if they did, well, they could use them. Basically, a galvanic cell, if you kind of reverse it, if you send electricity into it, you can use it to basically purify the cathode, really, the anode, excuse me, really well in a process called electrowinning.
I'm by winning. I win here and I win there.
It's used today and has been for over 200 years. And if they figured out that their batteries were batteries, then perhaps they also used the electricity for electrowinning. But they didn't even need to have such knowledge in order to use these as galvanic cells. And to the outside person, that would look like you were changing one metal into another. And that, my friends, would qualify as alchemy, which was my opinion why we see those scrolls stored inside of these jars that have the same elements in a different setup. Because these scrolls that they've been able to decipher, every one of them has been mystical, magical, something like that. Esoteric, hidden secret knowledge. So this could well be like symbolic. It could be a way to initiate people into this, these jars like this, and then on down the road. Another thing to contemplate here is these jars could have been used with like a gold cathode, and it would have attracted gold much, much better. And the gold would have certainly been salvaged by those prehistoric tweakers I was talking about earlier. At any rate, pointing out that there are scrolls in some doesn't really debunk the jars that could work, because we got to be painfully clear about these. The fact that some of these could function as galvanic cells shouldn't be dismissed without some serious investigation. Of course, the skeptics often get overzealous and cynical, and then we get arguments that don't stand up to scrutiny, and they seem to have an endless supply of problems with things like this. The Wikipedia page currently lists the lack of copper buildup on the cathode as part of the problem, one of the reasons to debunk these things. Now, of course, my hypothesis explains this, because they harvested the metals inside of there, so I expect the Wikipedia page may change. And in order to get out ahead of those skeptics that like to just kind of poo-poo all over everything, I'll answer the obvious question of how would they have discovered this process? How would they have figured it out? Because, like, everybody seems to think they're so stupid or something, but I'll explain it to you. Now, blue vitriol was a well-known pigment in ancient Rome, a dye and a paint and even a fungicide for crops. They hadn't figured out it was toxic as hell yet, so they used it where they shouldn't have, a lot like they did with lead. It was water-soluble and really bright and relatively common, so it wasn't a very expensive dye, and it was very popular. And it formed near the runoff of mines, copper mines. The chemical name for blue vitriol is copper sulfate pentahydrate, and it is hard to miss. Considering that the mines were full of funny-colored rocks that held riches in them, it's not a stretch to assume some ancient person looked at the buildup of copper in the mine runoff and deduced it might be metal. But I have an even better idea about this that could have been stumbled on. Imagine you've got a little puddle of this mine runoff, and you drop a coin in it by accident, copper coin, and somebody else had already dropped a nail in it, and you come back 2 weeks later and pick up that coin, and it's got a little bit of that copper buildup on it. That might be all it takes to put two and two together for somebody. What if that was a gold mine and you built up a piece of gold same way? Then you would really get with it, right? And I know some of you are going to say, oh, this is a crazy idea. This is really out there. Look at how they say we discovered cheese, all right? They say that somebody like put milk in a calf skin and then went on a big old journey. And then after a bunch of hours in the heat, the enzymes in the calf skin and the heat reacted with the milk, and bada bing, bada boom, you had curds and whey, and the rest is history.
Like eating too much cheese for dinner and then feeling terrible the morning after.
Me too, Sabine, and I also like you. You're one of my favorite YouTubers, and I watched you get crapped on once by somebody that I really don't like very much. I butted heads with him quite a bit, and I'm going to be talking about him a little bit in a video that's on my other channel, a link down below. I'm going to be trying to move kind of the argumenty stuff over to that channel and keep this more to the fun side of things so that the people that are like, miss me with that negative energy, bro, don't have to see it here. Now, I don't think that this is the be-all, end-all of the Baghdad Battery. I think there's a lot more that needs tested and explored, but I do think that this is most likely the best solution for what we see. This explains why we have these here with this setup, but also why we don't have a lot of the things that would be used for electricity. They probably didn't even know it made electricity, man. They just knew that it was alchemy, and they were all about it. Thank you very much for watching. I'm going to be in Sedona, Arizona, May 1st through 3rd. Links to purchase tickets down below. Links to support the channel down below. Links to my other social media presence down below. Link to my other channel down below. I'm going to be there in about 10 minutes. This thing's going to be premiering in about 10 minutes. I want to go there right now if you want to yell at me some for the second premiere. Thank you very much and have a good day.